Welcome back, everyone. Right? No, we're supposed to wear masks. Is it okay if I don't wear a mask? We'll delete that from the recording anyway.
Oh, I got one.
Noach, in this week's parasha, together with his family, spends a lot of time alone in the Teva, kind of what we would call today probably his boidedus, spending some time in isolation or solitude together with his family. And I wanted to take the opportunity, therefore, to discuss the topic of his boidedus, of spending time alone as a practice and as perhaps, you know, something that's become a little bit more common in our times. I'll be honest with you, it's outside of my wheelhouse of general exposure. I wasn't raised in a community that practiced hizboidedus, or even, you know, I don't think I even knew what the term meant probably growing up. I don't practice it now. I'm not a promoter of it. In a certain sense, it's outside of my wheelhouse, not only of experience, but really of interest. I typically am primarily focused on a mitzvah, a halacha, a pasuk, a maimer chazal. But the topic of hizboidedus has certainly received a lot of attention in our times. I don't know if it's crossed your path or not, but certainly potentially might in the future. So I think it's important to discuss where it came from, what it means, and what the purpose of it is, and really where does it fit into our hashgacha, particularly if it wasn't part of your education until now, either. It's kind of hard to grapple with and categorize and know how we feel about it until we understand where it came from and what it really, means. If you speak about his baydudus, most people probably think of a breast of a chassid sitting on the top of a mountain somewhere, humming some sort of, perhaps pasuk or something like that. And it seems like, Rabbi Nachman or Breslov created this practice of his baydudus. So that's probably incorrect. That's not true. But at the same time, it's certainly not correct either that they didn't change it or introduce new themes within his baydudus. That is certainly true. So as we'll see, the concept, the practice might have existed traditionally or classically, but it has evolved, certainly, and was evolved by Breslov. It's hard to speak about it, though, with precise terms and definitions, somewhat of an elusive topic, as we'll see, because the definitions and the practices have become conflated. There's a lot of different practices, a lot of different motivations for doing it, and so they've kind of joined together, and things have evolved over time, but we'll do our best to kind of pick it apart and see maybe there are points that can benefit all of us, maybe things that we can think about later how we feel about them. But I think it's just important to understand, as Jews living in the current context, where did this come from? How do we feel about it? What exactly, is the purpose of it? And, how does it fit into the rest of our Avodas Hashem, given the fact that it's not like a pasuk in the Torah, it's not a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, or a mitzvah per se, or a maimer chazal that at least we're, aware of, that directs us to engage in this. So, first of all, how far back does this go? So it seems that it goes back, quite far. The Rambam, actually, in Hilchos Yisoidei HaTorah, Perek Zayin, not from the most often studied sections of the Rambam, because the Rambam is discussing what qualities a person needs in order to become a Navi, to become a prophet, which is not, the career aspirations of, most people. We should be, but and not something that we're thinking about in practical terms about how to become a Navi. But the Rambam there discusses how does a person become a Navi, and the Rambam writes that this is, of course, the crowning achievement of a spiritual career. A person has been shalet, he's completely in control of his actions and of his, of his desires. He's mastered the Yetzer Hara, and he's in complete control in the physical world. And what, comes after that is that a person then can attempt to control his thoughts as well, and to focus entirely on the Ribbono Shel Olam. He is not concerned at all, with the desire, with the things that keep us busy in the physical world. This individual is completely focused on spiritual pursuits, and he occupies himself completely with the spiritual world, almost divorcing himself from the physical world entirely. And the Rambam writes, when a person has achieved that level of you know, not only in terms of physical control, but that spiritual level as well, in terms of his thought process, that he's completely focused on the Ribbono Shel Olam at all times, and the person, you know, that's one of the prerequisites. But then the person is also in the proper state of mind. He has to be besimcha. Sometimes they used to play music, you know, in order to induce and create the right kind of atmosphere that would precipitate nevuah. And one of the practices that Rambam includes in that long list of things that after a person has reached this level and he's trying to create the proper environment to be zayecha, to precipitate nevuah, one of the things he would do would be mizbaided, would be to sit in solitude, to sit alone, perhaps in contemplation. And then, maybe or maybe not, the person could be zayecha to nevuah. The Rambam writes, it's not a precise, you know, exact equation that if you follow the following steps, you'll inevitably achieve nevuah. It's something Kadosh Baruch Hu has to bestow upon you, even if you checked all the boxes along the way. So that's what the Rambam mentions. His boididus is in the context of precipitating nevuah. The Rambam doesn't really develop it fully as a practice or as a movement. That is done by the Rambam's son. You know, if you would have asked who is the father of the his boididus movement, probably the last address you would have had, if you know anything about the Rambam, would be the Rambam. But it seems to be it comes from the Rambam's son, Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam, who was a sefer called Hamaspik La'evdei Hashem. You know, a guide for people who serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, people who read Hamaspik Le'evdei Hashem is not I don't even know if we have one in this space medrash. It's found in the library. It's a popular sefer, but not, you know, something that's found, you know, in every base medrash. There are two really things, you know, two sections of the Hamaspik Le'evdei Hashem that are really studied. One is his comments about Bitachon, which resonate with us today. He really is the source for the Chazon Ish's approach to Bitachon. If you ever go in the Chazon Ish's Sefer Emunah Bitachon, when the Chazon Ish describes that Bitachon does not mean if I trust in the Kadosh Baruch Hu, everything will turn out well and I'll get everything that I want if I trust in the Kadosh Baruch Hu. What it means is, and it's a little bit more, you know, appeals to us in the modern sense and the rationalist, you know, rationalist that we are, that what it means is everything that happens to me will be the Ratzon Hashem. And there's a certain security in that, knowing that I'm not vulnerable to the winds of happenstance and chance. Anything that happens to me is because the Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted it to happen. Good, bad, whatever, Eloheinu, whatever it should be, that's, you know, that's the Ratzon Hashem. And if you trust in the Kadosh Baruch Hu, hopefully, you know, Chesed will surround you, but it doesn't guarantee that that's what will occur. That's the Chazon Ish's approach to Emunah Bitachon. That's already found in the Sefer Hamaspik Le'evdei Hashem, you know, going back to the times of the Rishonim. But then there's another section in the Sefer Hamaspik Le'evdei Hashem, where he discusses his boididus. And there he outlines a whole shahr on his boididus, pages and pages and pages. And there he explains that there's really two parts to his boididus. One is his boididus chitzonis, which is physical seclusion, you know, person distancing himself from the society around him in a physical way. And then there's his boididus pnimis, a person who is distanced, not physically, you know, in terms of his proximity, but you know, emotionally, you know, in terms of spiritually, not really connected with his surroundings. He's entirely communing with the Ribbono Shel Olam wherever, you know, he goes, and despite his surroundings. And Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam writes that the purpose of his boidus chitzonis is to achieve his boidus pnimis. A person sometimes will have to distance himself physically in proximity from his surroundings in order to achieve the goal, which is his boidus pnimis. And that's not a new idea. The Rambam writes, this is one of the more famous passages in the Rambam, in Hilchos Deos, that if a person lives in a society that is morally corrupt, what should he do? He should move to a different community that's perhaps of higher spiritual stature. And let's say there is no such community that, you know, around him, or he doesn't have access to such a community, then he should run to the hills and, you know, kind of live in a cave in seclusion. You know, that's the Rambam's solution to, you know, whatever, to, you know, to the ills of society. If you can't solve them, you can't find somewhere else to live, you just have to run away. Why? So the Rambam writes, because the nature of people is to be nimshach, to be influenced by their environment. That's the way, you know, that people are. It's the way we're designed. The Rambam writes, it's something that's, you know, we can't overcome that. We're influenced, whether we like it or not, whether we realize it or not, whether we admit it or not, we're all influenced by our surroundings. And therefore, if a person sees that he's in an environment that's not productive, you know, or not healthy, so then they should move to another community, if not possible, you know, move somewhere, you know, into seclusion, because you have no other choice. So we see from that comment of the Rambam already that moving yourself physically, removing yourself from the community, can be sometimes of a spiritual benefit. But even if you're living within a community that is of the, you know, is a healthy community, that is a proper spiritual, you know, status, just being involved in community of people in general who are inevitably involved in physical pursuits, who are judgmental, who are, you know, engaging each other based on, you know, accomplishments and possessions and whatever goes along of being part of a community of human beings, a little bit pulls us, think, you know, into the world of physicality. And if a person wants to live in the world of spirituality, inevitably he has to, you know, distance himself from the society around them. So his bodhis paninis, if a person wants to connect with the Kaddish Baruch Hu on the highest level spiritually, inevitably he's going to have to pull himself out of his physical surroundings, because it's almost inescapable, the physicality of any community, even the highest spiritual caliber, there's physicality around it. So therefore, writes Rabbi Raman, to achieve this, his bodhis paninis, it's critical that a person, you know, distance themselves through his bodhis chitzionis. Now that's not meant to be something that's permanent, right? Rabban Ben Aramam writes, it could be that it's only from time to time, intermittently. It doesn't even have to be, you know, completely. A person can isolate themselves for a period of time in a room within a house. It's also a kind of hisbaididus, you know, chitzainis, which can generate, that can precipitate this kind of hisbaididus pnimis, this kind of, you know, continuous communion with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and entirely divorced from all the kinds of the burdens of the physical world. So this hisbaididus chitzainis is in order to lead to hisbaididus pnimis. But even if you're able to achieve this hisbaididus pnimis, which is at the, you know, the highest echelons of spiritual accomplishment, bordering on nevuah, even if a person is able to achieve that, that's not meant to be a permanent state of isolation from the community. The whole purpose of even those who achieve that state of isolation is only in order to be more involved in the community, to contribute further to the community. Meaning, by achieving my own spiritual potential, I'm able now to be a greater asset to the community. You don't necessarily go into it with that in mind, but his bodhis paninis was never a goal, even of those of the highest spiritual status, was to divorce themselves from the rest of the community. Just sometimes I need to distance myself from the community, you know, physically, in order to achieve my spiritual potential, which then itself becomes an asset to the community. Let's just think about the greatest Nevi'im, right? The Nevi'im who we had in our community, in our history, in our ancestry, also the greatest leaders of Klal Yisrael. So even though, in order to achieve this kind of high spiritual state, you have to distance yourself a little bit physically, in order to lead to that his bodhis paninis, that spiritual isolation, a kind of communion with the Ribbono Shel Olam, all of that is only in order to enable a person to become a greater asset to the community. You're never supposed to be divorced, you know, entirely from the community. That's not our aspiration. Rav Soloveitchik in the Lonely Man of Faith, which maybe you're familiar with, so he outlines the two stories of creation of Adam HaRishon, one in Perek Aleph of Bereishis, one in Perek Beis. And he calls the Adam HaRishon in Perek Aleph, who's really given the job of Pru, Revu, Mu'ulas, Haaretz, V'Kivshua, to conquer and to settle and to subdue the physical world. He gives him the name, you know, Majestic Man, because his aspiration is to conquer all of the, you know, and subdue and to settle the entire physical world. As opposed to Adam, the story of the creation of Adam HaRishon in Perek Beis, which the Rav describes as the man of faith, whose job is to V'yinicheyu began Eden la'avda u'lishamra. He was put into the spiritual world to settle that, to work in that world, and to kind of, you know, connect with the Kaddish Baruch Hu in that way. And every human being is created with these two poles, these two personalities that live within us. We live in a physical world. We also are here to settle the spiritual world. And we kind of have this tug of war that goes on inside of us constantly. That's what the Rav meant to describe with these two stories of the creation of Adam HaRishon. But there's a critical difference between them in that, and the Rav, of course, makes this point, that in the creation of Adam in Perek Aleph, which is describing his tafkid, to settle the physical world, there he's created together with Chava initially. Zachar Nekeva Baro Osam. That's because I cannot settle the physical world by myself. I need other people to help me do that. It's a utilitarian purpose, it's transactional. I just can't do it alone, so you need other people to help you achieve that goal, inevitably. However, in Perek Beis, when the Torah describes the creation of Adam HaRishon, there, it's not Zachar Nekeva Baro Osam initially. Initially, Adam HaRishon was created alone. But then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Loi Toiv Hayoysa Adam Levadai, Ese Loi Ezer Kenegdai. It's not good for man to be alone. Let me create, you know, Chava, a companion, along with him. And the Rav explains that it's because in the spiritual world, every person is created alone, because each person has a unique tafkid that is, you know, that is entirely their own, right? A person, every person is, a person who saves a life is ki'ilu hitzil olamola, as if you save the entire world, because every person has something that's unique to them, and that's why they were alone. Every person is kind of alone in the creation of the world, because each person has a unique tafkid. And that's what his baidus is there to achieve, is that kind of, what is my tafkid and my connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's personal. At the same time, v'toiv hayoyis ha'odom, Levadai. And here the Rav explains that we have a faith community as well, the covenantal community, he calls it. That's not in a transactional sense. It's not in a utilitarian sense. That's not that I just can't do it alone, so I need other people to help me out because the box is too heavy or the refrigerator is too heavy and I can't move it unless someone else helps me move it. It's that we are united all with each of our own personal missions around the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that unites us in a fundamental sense. Not because it's simply, you know, a practical bond between us. It's something that's a little bit more fundamental. But again, every person is created alone, like Adam Arishin, but that's not our purpose. Our purpose is not to remain alone. The purpose of his Hisbaidudus, of course, is in order to, and every Navi, is in order to achieve a greater contribution towards that faith covenantal community. That's why we have phrases like "Lotayv Hayoyis Adam Levado." It's axiomatic. It's not good for a person to be alone. Or "O Chavrusa O Misusa." Either a person has, you know, companions and friends, or he'll wither away. Because in order for us to achieve our mission, we have to contribute to the community. Every person has a unique mission, but paradoxically, even though we're so unique, we each have a role to play within the covenantal community. So that's why a person could practice his baidus in the wrong way, even at this highest spiritual echelons and levels, where they're just distance themselves from society, from the community. Of course, you know, that's wrong. The Morav HaShemesh, one of the classical Chassidish Sfarim, quotes in the name of the Rebbe Elimelech of Vizhensk. He says, a person could be misbaided so much that they divorce themselves from a Kaddish Baruch Hu too. Meaning, if you're so alone that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't figure into your equation either, well, then that's, of course, misguided his baidus. That's why they quote in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, he has a tzavo. He has a last will and testament called the Tzavos HaRivosh. The Rivosh was a Rishon. But this Rivosh is Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. So in the Tzavo of the Rivosh, he says, if you're going to do his baidus, always has to be together with one chaver, with one chavrusa. Never to allow a person to become untethered, become unmoored from the shores of reality and the community. Okay, but that's where we find his baidus in the classical sense, is in the context of what precipitates nevuah. And even there, it was never meant to distance one from the community. It was meant to allow every person to develop their own personal potential and contribute even more to the community. Sometimes you'd have to follow the path of hisbaidus chitzainis, external hisbaidus, in order to generate this kind of hisbaidus panimis. Where do we find this? Who do we find practicing this? Rabbi Avraham ben Aramim goes on in his dissertation on hisbaidus. And he writes, this goes all the way back to Noach in this week's parasha. He writes, Noach, of course, was found in the Teva all alone. And Noach, to a certain degree, Noach is criticized for this, in that he removed himself from the community perhaps too much, as opposed to Avram Avinu, who was Hisalech Lefanav Hayei Samim. Noach was Esho Elohim Hisalech Noach. Avram Avinu not only achieved his own spiritual potential, but then contributed to the rest of society, and uplifting the whole world together with him. Noach, a little bit withdrew from society, but he did achieve great things all by himself. He was being misbaided on the Teva. But then Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam continues that Avraham Avinu obviously also practiced his baididus. Because Rambam tells us, how did Avraham Avinu discover HaKadosh Baruch Hu? He was sitting, looking at the stars, pondering the purpose of the universe and his role within it. And if there's a universe, there must be a creator. And the whole story of discovery of Avraham Avinu, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, must have taken place, while he was sitting in solitude contemplating these things. But then he proves it, or he thinks he proves it, from the Pasuk. The Pasuk says, at the time of the Akedah, Avram, Yitzchak, Yishmael, and Eliezer get to the Makom HaMikdash, right? Avram Avinu says to Yishmael and Eliezer, Shvu lachem poi im hachamor. You guys stay here with the donkey, v'ani v'anar ne'chad koi. I'm going to go with Yitzchak to the Makom HaMikdash. So Rabbi Avraham ben Aramim says, why didn't anyone say to Avraham Avinu, what are you going on alone for? It's dangerous. Don't go alone. Take us all with you. Safety is in numbers. Why did he go alone? So Rabbi Avraham ben Aramim makes, you could argue with this, obviously, but he says, no, it's because Avraham Avinu was always alone. He was always walking alone. He must have always been misbaided, because he was always, kind of sitting in solitude thinking. Okay, you could argue with that. I don't think it's, necessarily conclusive, but that's the argument of Rabbi ben Aramim. But certainly we find the Torah describes Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basoda. Yitzchak Avinu was out, right, as Rivka is arriving. He's out davening in the field. Chazal tells us, ain't Sicha Latfila, but here he is, kind of communing in nature in the middle of the field. Yaakov Avinu, right? The Torah tells us, Vayivaser Yaakov, who's the only one who's ever described as being alone, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is Vinitzkav Hashem Levadoi, but Yaakov Avinu is also Vayivaser Yaakov Levadoi. And what happens when he's sitting alone going back for his Pachim Ketanim? He encounters a Malach. He has, you know, kind of a Gilui of Ruach HaKadosh. Because when a person is misbaided, when they're all by themselves, they can reach higher, you know, spiritual levels. Vayivaser Yaakov Levadoi, Vayayovik Ishima. But Yaakov Avinu is also known, right, as Yaakov Ishtam Yoshev Ha'olim. Yaakov Avinu is the complete man who dwells in tents. So I'll tell you, I always thought Yaakov Avinu is the complete man who dwells in tents. That means he sits in a base medrash and it's full of people. But Rabbi Avraham ben Aram says, no, that's not what it means. What it means is he dwelt in a tent by himself, in solitude, in a tent. And he was living all by himself. So maybe all of the others, according to Rabbi Avraham ben Aram, practiced his baidudus. They were all sitting by themselves. But He makes another argument that's already echoed by Rabbeinu Bach and many others in Chumash, and that is that we find that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were all shepherds. So until now, if you would have asked me why were they all shepherds, I would have said, well, they were limited career options, you know, in the ancient world. What were you going to do? I guess you could be a fisherman, a shepherd, a farmer. You weren't going to be an investment banker, right? So what a computer programmer. So what else were you going to... a counselor, you know, a speech therapist. What were you going to do in the ancient world? So your career options were limited. However, Rabbeinu Bachya and Rabbeinu ben Aram say, no, they were all Roi Tzon, because you know what happens when you're a Roi Tzon? You have a lot of downtime. Many people pick careers based on how much right downtime they have. So they have so much downtime because they're sitting alone, watching the sheep. You know, it gives you time to sit and to think about the Ribbono Shel Olam, focus your thoughts all on spirituality. So they all chose that profession on purpose. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were all right, they were all shepherds, in order to give themselves time to really to be misbaided with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We even find when they get to Mitzrayim, the Shvatim Tel Paroi, right? We're right, son. So what does that mean? They can't live within the community. Where do they settle? In Goshen, in a community set off from the larger society, because right, son are not like people who can live in larger circles, you know, and more densely populated areas. They have to live out on the outskirts of town, because there were people who enjoyed, you know, being alone. And you see that the others perhaps chose this profession because it led them, you know, let them have the freedom to be misbaided. Moshe Rabbeinu was a royal son. David HaMelech was a royal son. They were all shepherds, perhaps for the same reason, because they wanted time to be misbaided. And if you think about it in the proper lens, right, when did Moshe Rabbeinu reach his greatest spiritual heights? You know, I guess at the end of his life. But, you know, his crowning achievement, of course, was receiving the Torah Maimed Har Sinai, which was all by himself. Moshe Rabbeinu was on Har Sinai all by himself. The holiest person in Klal Yisrael, the Kohen Gadol, would encounter Kodesh Baruch Hu in the Kodesh HaKadoshim without anyone else there, being misbaided, communing with the Ribbono Shel Olam. So one could already, you know, get the sense that his baidus, this is a classical part, you know, of Judaism. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, David, the Kohen Gadol, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, right, achieved his mystical, spiritual heights in the cave, alone with his son, being misbaided. So if you look at the history of Yiddishkeit through the lens of Rambam and Rambam, this is something that seems to be a traditional concept. In this context, what does his baidus mean? So I think what his baidus would mean is, as the Rambam describes it in the context, you know, of Nevuah, is after a person has controlled all of his actions, all of his desires, now he wants to control his thoughts and thinking, focusing completely on the Ribbono Shel Olam at all times, spiritual matters, divorcing himself entirely from the physical needs of this world and the, you know, the and all that entails. So then he focuses completely on the spiritual. That's what, you know, that's the goal of his Baidus Pnimis, his Baidus Chitzonis, in order to lead to this kind of his Baidus Pnimis. That's what leads Aryeh Kaplan. Aryeh Kaplan was a real rocket scientist, I think, by profession, he died very young, but was prolific. His lifetime wrote so many books that are so important, basic books on Yiddishkeit, if you've never read his book on Shabbos, so many important works. But he did a lot of work on this topic of his Baidus, which he describes I never saw it, you know, before him, but he describes it as a kind of a meditation. If you think about it, and just to put it into modern terms, what is controlled thinking? Controlled thinking we would probably call a meditation. And he says that's why the Rambam describes what precipitated his Vodidus, you know, or Nevuah, was a kind of controlled thinking together with music. Because music, that kind of humming, or that kind of, you know, that kind of mantra, you say over the same thing again and again, you hear the same thing again and again, is what can induce a higher state of consciousness and, you know, this kind of meditative state. And that's what precipitated Nevuah, was this kind of, you know, transcendental experience that a person could have if they had, you know, entered into this meditative state, in this higher altered state of consciousness. And that's why the Rambam describes it in the context of Nevuah. It's because a person is completely controlling his thoughts. But that's why the Rambam writes, if a person will try and do this, you know, earlier on, he hasn't yet controlled his actions and desires. He really, you know, hasn't mastered the Yetzer Hara. He really hasn't plumbed the depths of, you know, the theological and philosophical underpinnings of what it means, you know, what the Ribbono Shel Olam means and our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Then what is he sitting and pondering? The Rambam writes, then his Baidus kind of makes no sense. It has no traction. What are you thinking about? If you remove it from the previous steps that got you there, it loses a kind of, you know, a lot of its meaning. Where does it make sense in a person who's controlled every other aspect of their life? All that's left to control is their thoughts. So then you had his kind of his bodhidus, which was entering into a kind of meditative state where there was controlled thinking. That's why, you know, most of us were not brought up with his bodhidus, because that's a pretty high spiritual level. You know, and we don't have Nevuah anymore, so what purpose really would his Baidudus kind of serve? So Ari Kaplan actually writes that his Baidudus was not lost, or this whole kind of meditative state of Nevuah was not lost. It was actually replaced by something else. And this same point is made by Rav Soloveitchik in The Lonely Man of Faith. He writes this explicitly, that prophecy, Nevuah, was replaced by something else, which also has a kind of similar focus, even though we probably don't think of it normally in that way. The Gemara says in Masechtas Sanhedrin that it once happened that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola had a unique Eis Ratzon, time of mercy before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where Hashem was willing to grant them their request. And they asked to disband, to remove the Eis Hara of Avodah Zarah. It was just too overwhelming. We have no connection to this. We don't understand why were they bowing down to totem poles and the sun and the moon. These things don't appeal to us. But that's because the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was disabled. It was removed by and large. But it used to exist. The Gemara says, you know, in the times when the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was in its heyday, the gravitational pull of it was enormous. The Gemara says it was just too much for them. They asked Kadosh Baruch Hu to remove it. Kadosh Baruch Hu granted their request, and at the time, in the times of Nehemiah and the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and they, Kadosh Baruch Hu, removed the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, and they saw at that time a lion cub walking out of the Kodesh HaKadosh and represented the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah leaving. It was leaving the Kodesh HaKadosh. Why was the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah leaving the Kodesh HaKadosh? So the answer is because the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, what that is a potential for a mystical, transcendental experience. When that left, right, and there was a great pull to that, that led a person to worship Avodah Zarah. When that transcendental, mystical, you know, potential was lost, we lost something along with it too. What did we lose? We lost Nevuah. That's why the period of Nevuah ended at the same time, because we lost that potential together with the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. But that was not the only thing that Anshei Knesset HaGedola did. They did something else critical in order to take the place of this vacuum. Now that we lost Nevuah and this ability to connect and commune with the Kadosh Baruch Hu in this way, they replaced it with something else. Not replacing Nevuah, but kind of perpetuating the same experience, but in a different form. And that is the form of Tefillah. It was the Anshei Knesset HaGedola who formalized Tefillah. Until the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, a person could pray whenever he wanted, in whatever language he wanted. Because it was possible for them, there were schools of Nevi'im, hordes of Nevi'im. Because they had this ability for this transcendental, mystical experience. Many people were at the highest echelons of spirituality, and they were able to connect with the Kadosh Baruch Hu and commune with him in this way, focusing all their thoughts, you know, completely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, entering into this higher state of consciousness of Nevuah. But when that potential was lost, so you couldn't pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu whenever you wanted. You couldn't use whatever nusach you wanted because you didn't know the spiritual underpinnings of it. So what the Anshei Knesset HaGedola did was they replaced it with tefillah. They replaced it with tefillah. And that's the purpose of tefillah, is to create that same kind of prophetic experience of communing, being in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, there's words you have to say, and it's an obligatory thing to do, you know, from time to time, three times a day or whatever, but that's the dressing of it. But what it's there to accomplish is to stand before, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a similar way to Nevuah. Nevuah, Hashem speaks to us. Tefillah, we speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that was the, you know, they perpetuated Nevuah. Now that the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah had been removed, the potential for real Nevuah had been, you know, also removed. They replaced that experience or perpetuated it with, through the medium of Tefillah. But that's why, I think Rabbi Nachman actually writes in the Likutei Maran, that we call the Shliach Tzibor, it's called a Chazon. Chazon, Miloshon, Chazon. Chazon, it's like Chazon Ovadia. That's the Sefer. Chazon Yecheskel, right? Yecheskel saw a Nevuah. So Chazon means a person who's able to see a prophetic vision. We call the Chazon a Chazon, you know, Miloshon Chazon, because this is perpetuating or replacing kind of prophecy in that way, and then we're interacting in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbi Kaplan writes, that's why, probably never thought of it this way, it's the same tefillah every day. Wouldn't you think in the vicissitudes in life and all the challenges that we have, the nusach of tefillah should change? Shouldn't it reflect what I'm going through today? Maybe you have a choice of 15, you know, if you're in this kind of predicament, this tefillah, this kind of predicament, that tefillah. You know, we should have, all kind of in the same bag of problems. So let's, you know, have a tefillah for this, a tefillah for that. And we kind of do have that, right? A tefillah based Sarah. But the basic formula of tefillah and the essence of tefillah, Shmoneh Esrei, same thing, three times a day, from the day that, a person is able to daven in school to the end of their life, I may have asked from Shana, the same tefillah, again and again and again. So Arya Kaplan, you know, kind of repackages that, reframes it for us, that it's kind of a mantra. A mantra means the thing you repeat over and over and over again, delving into it deeper, pondering it more, and that's what induces, you know, that's a meditative, transcendental meditation is usually mantra-focused. You say the same thing again and again and again, and it enables you to focus all of your energies and concentration on that one phrase. And that's the purpose of the Shemoneh Esrei, every day the same thing, was to induce this kind of meditative experience akin, you know, kind of being perpetuating Nevuah. That's why we never thought of it this way either, probably, unless you read of I Kaplan's books. But that's why the Gemara says in Brachos, the Chassidim HaRishonim, the original Chassidim, used to come to Shul an hour early, sit and think, and then after davening, they would ride around another hour, sitting and thinking. What were they thinking about? Were they learning Daf Yomi? What were they doing? And they were probably focusing their concentration, you know, on achieving this higher meditative state. They, see, the Ma'ariv Rishonim were close to the time to the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. They still remembered what Nevuah was about, and they were trying, and it doesn't kind of translate for us, but what they were trying to do is, you know, recreate that same meditative experience. So that's why, you know, it's been perpetuated through Tefillah, which is an entirely different, you know, kind of experience, and that's why his Beididus really kind of doesn't figure anymore into the equation, really got boxed out. Because now that we're not in that raw meditative experience, like Nevuah has been replaced by Tefillah, his Beididus doesn't really figure in terms of the experience of Tefillah, which is not really the same as Nevuah, even if it is along the same, you know, along the same lines. However, classical his Beididus, I think, has evolved by the Bali Musar, and I would say by the Bali Chassidus as well, the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. There is overlap between the Bali Musar and the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. Original Chassidim, is that they were, they both adopted the practice. You know, once his Beididus is in our tool chest, right? It's something that's in our quiver. So it's useful. It could be useful for other things. So they kind of channeled the practice of his Beididus away from Nevuah and more towards something else, which is a kind of a Cheshbon HaNefesh. You know, it's helpful to have time where you can be misbeided, if not to precipitate Nevuah, the higher echelons of spiritual accomplishment where a person rules over his actions and his desires and therefore can concentrate all of his thoughts on the spiritual world and remove himself completely from the physical world, bordering on precipitating Nevuah, that's beyond us a little bit. It's been replaced, that same experience of Nevuah has been replaced by Tefillah, which is more organized by the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah on our behalf because they limited our ability for Nevuah by removing the Yetzer Hara from the Zohar, so they gave us Tefillah instead. That kind of misbeididus more or less lost. But now, the Bali Musar, the Bali Chassidus adopted it as a practice that's helpful for tshuva, for spiritual growth. Right? Sometimes we're so busy in life, we don't take time and to do the proper Cheshbon HaNefesh. So the Chafetz Chaim, was not a chassid by any means, in his Bir Halacha, in Hilchos Tanios, where he's describing fasting as a form of tshuva, writes that in the name of the Ari HaKodesh, today it's more productive than all the fasting you can do to be mizbaided for a set time, you know, on a regular schedule, take time away from other activities, maybe physically, maybe figuratively, but detaching from all of the things that you have going on in your life and perform a cheshbon hanefesh. You know, think about what is the purpose of my existence? What do I hope to achieve in life? And am I getting there? Where am I holding in terms of, you know, my spiritual accomplishment? And in fact, the Baal HaTanya writes like that too, in the name of the Baal Shem Tov and others, that it's a helpful, you know, practice to spend time thinking about the person's actions. All too, you know, Chafetz Chaim didn't live the kind of life that we have, you know, with all of our distractions. Chafetz Chaim lived in a one-horse town in Radin, and he said, you need to take time, you know, away in order to be, you know, make a cheshbon hanefesh. The Ari HaKadosh lived in Tzfas in the 1600s, not, you know, the kind of environment that we live in. How more important than, you know, is it in our time to take time to detach and disconnect, we call it today, right? And make a cheshbon hanefesh. In that sense, it's baididus is a very useful activity. Now, that his baididus is not what the Rambam was talking about in the context of Nebuah. It's an entirely, it's a similar word, right? But again, the topics have been conflated. It's not really the continuation of the old his baididus. It's kind of a refashioning, a facelift on the old his baididus, something that makes sense for us, which is to, you know, take time to disconnect and perform a cheshbon hanefesh. Not in a depressing way, not to sit and to wallow about our mistakes and to, you know, create anxiety about it, just the opposite. To do so in a controlled way, in a non-judgmental way, and think about where we want to go and, you know, kind of, I guess, focus where we are now and, you know, make the most of that and feel good about that and hopefully put ourselves in a proper course to succeed in the future. So if you're familiar with kind of more pop psychology, I think this is closer to what people now today call mindfulness. It's not meditation. Meditation is entirely different. This is mindfulness. It's a person living in the present. You know, I'm not an expert on mindfulness, but what I've been told about mindfulness is, and again, I think that this also doesn't have a precise definition necessarily, but it's more, probably people know more about it than I do, but it's kind of living in the moment. I don't know, there are exercises involved. I don't know if that's essential, but, you know, kind of maybe that's to induce a state of mindfulness, but living in the moment, thinking about feeling today, feeling now, detaching from the anxiety of the past and the worries about the future, and, you know, I guess feeling good about where you are now and enjoying the here and now, as opposed to, you know, the busyness of life that sometimes leads us to be anxious about this and regretful about that. Live in the here and now. So in a certain sense, I don't know if it's exactly the same, but that's what the Baal HaMusar are talking about, is that this is a traditional topic, at least for the Baal HaMusar and the Baal HaSidus. Take time to make a cheshbon hanefesh. Again, not in a depressing way. Depressing sadness has no place in Yiddishkeit. That's the Yetzer Hara. The Ari HaKadosh writes, the terrible midah of atzvos, of depression, of being sad about things. You know, sometimes it overcomes people, but we have to do our best to, you know, to deal with it. But there is a certain sense, you know, of reflection that's healthy if it's done in a controlled way. And that's what this kind of his baididus is there to generate, kind of, you know, feel where I am and where do I want to be. And that's, you know, that's certainly a productive activity, although not related at all to what the Rambam was talking about in his baididus. What's new about Breslover, his baididus, is that it's old and new at the same time. And that's not my phrase, that's not my way of phrasing it. That's Rabbi Nachman is quoted as saying, it's an old and new path. And he explains what he means. What he means is the goal is the same, but the method is different. To give a mashal to a person who's traveling to a city, and there's a certain highway that gets you there, but the road got washed out. Picture you're traveling, well, you don't understand washed out, your car could drive through it, but no, you're in a horse and carriage. Your horse can't pass because it's too muddy. So what do? You take a side route and go through forest, where I guess it's not as muddy, and then you're able to get to the city. So Nachman explained that that's how what he was accomplishing with his brand of his baididus. And what he means by that is that he's going back to the same old town where his baididus started. His baididus started as a communion with a Kaddish Baruch Hu, a person who's focused all of his thoughts on the Ribbono Shel Olam. The problem is it's hard to get there. The road is washed out. We abandon that kind of his baididus. You know why? Because it comes as the crowning achievement to a life of control. A person's in control of their actions, in control of their desires. And then he's in control of everything, and then he kind of, you know, divorces himself from all of the problems of this world and focuses completely on the Ribbono Shel Olam and spiritual pursuits. That's hard to get there. The road is washed out, so we gave up getting there. So Rabbi Nachman says, no, I have a different way. And that's his new kind of his way of this. Rabbi Nachman also has, not that I'm promoting it, people should just know about it. He has a story called The Lost Princess. I don't know if people are familiar with the story. But all of his stories are Kabbalistic stories. They're drenched in Kabbalistic meaning. But obviously also has, you know, other messages too. So the story is about a king, who obviously representing the Ribbono Shel Olam, who has 7 children, 6 sons and 1 daughter. The 7 children represent, in Kabbalistic terms, if this, you know, means anything to you, the 7 lower midos. There's 10 spheros. 3 of them are moichin, chachma bina das, ways of thinking, higher levels of functioning. The midos are physical manifestations or expressions of the Ribbono Shel Olam in this world. You know, chesed, gvura, tiferes, netzach, chod, yesod, malchus. So the bottom one is malchus. That's the one that, you know, that collects all of the spiritual sparks that are coming from above. That's the 6 children. And the 6 sons and the one daughter represent the 7 midos, the 7 lower midos that Kadosh Baruch Hu finds expression in this world. Kadosh Baruch Hu gets angry at the princess, banishes her away. That represents the fact that it's hard to find the Hashra'as Hashchina in this world. At the time of the creation of the world, the Kadosh Baruch Hu sent away the Hashra'as Hashchina for whatever reason, dropped the sparks of Kedusha throughout the world, and our job is to kind of elevate the world and bring it back to, demonstrate the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and by doing the Torah and the mitzvahs, that creates a Hashra'as Hashchina, a Gilui Shchina, a revelation of Hashem. So that represents, this lost princess. But it's hard to do that, right? It's an elusive goal in this world to create a Hashra'as Hashchina, a Gilui Shchina. That represents the lost princess. That's why it's an important idea, I guess. So, the king has a servant, a Mishnah Omelech. And that servant's job, he sets out to go find the lost princess, meaning to make a Gilui Shchina in this world. And the king gives him 3 things. He gives him a servant, he gives him a horse, and he gives him money. That represents, the servant is the neshama, the horse is the guf, money is mitzvos. All 3 together, by doing mitzvos with the guf, you can create a gilui shchina, you can find the lost princess. So he goes out to find the lost princess, but he can't find out where she is. So he's along on the road, and he's lost. And he sees, this is Rabbi Nachman writes, a path off to the side. The main road is washed out. He sees a path off to the side. He contemplates whether or not to take that path. Ultimately, he takes that path, sits and contemplates, and he finds the princess for the first time. He ends up losing the princess, because in order to redeem her, he has to spend a year not falling asleep. And instead, he eats an apple and falls asleep. A reference, obviously, to Adam Arishin, who ate from the Eitz Hadas and lost the ability to create a Hashra'as Hashchina in this world. It's interesting that it's an apple. Christians say that the Eitz Hadas was an apple. Our tradition is it was either grain, esrig, whatever. No, we don't hold it was an apple, but Rabbi Nachman has in the story an apple. Then he finds her again, and this time the test is he's not allowed to drink wine and fall asleep. He ends up drinking wine, falling asleep, and loses her again. Obviously a reference to Noach in this week's parasha, who drank wine, fell asleep, disappointed at Kadosh Baruch Hu, and then we had Hashra'as Hashchina in its full sense didn't take place. Then he loses her again. He ultimately finds her. And then the story ends without coming to a completion, representing the fact that we know in the end there's going to be a coming of Mashiach. We'll find the princess, but we don't know how it's going to unfold. Very beautiful story. But what you see again over here is the path that's off to the side is a kind of hisboidudus. That's why he contemplates whether or not to take that path. Ultimately, he takes that path, and that path leads him back to the princess. And what that path is a new way of reaching the kind of prophetic hisboidudus that we were talking about at the beginning, but not through the old traditional means that the Rambam was talking about. That road is washed out. There's a new way of getting there, which is the method of hisboidudus that's unique to Breslev. And there's 2 features to Breslev or hisboidudus which are interrelated. One is that they always talk out loud. You have to talk out loud. And you have, which is a kind of tefillah, tashem, whatever's on your mind, just say it, And you have to be in nature. So, what are both of them driving at? He's going back to the old form of tefillah that existed before tefillah was formalized. He's not advocating for not davening in the way that we daven, but on top of that, going back to what tefillah used to be, which is kind of bordering on nevuah without, you know, a kind of a freelance tefillah, connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every sense of our lives at all times, and then communing in nature with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why specifically in nature? Because recognizing, and this is the chiddush of Rabbi Nachman, is that a person can reach this kind of unity with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this kind of communing with the Ribbono Shel Olam, not through the methods of self-control, like the Rambam was talking about, like Nevuah. A person can reach it kind of backing into it the other direction, meaning a person can recognize that he is so subservient to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kind of removing his entire ego, removing all of his assumptions about himself, and recognizing the fact that he's no different than the trees, I guess, you know, kind of like being at one with nature, they would call it, but recognizing he also is a Bria in the Ribbono Shel Olam's world, just like Ani Tolas Velo Ish, as David HaMelech says. I'm a worm also. I'm a creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu too. This is a tree, a piece of grass, a creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and do the will of Hashem, so do I. And we're really no difference, and in that sense, a person can commune with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every sense, you know, in every part of his life, not through the methods of self-control we were discussing before in the highest spiritual echelons, but through just simply removing his ego and representing, you know, recognizing that he's just a bria of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that takes tremendous humility, tremendous vulnerability, for a person to recognize that he's, you know, no different than the tree, who you know, also has a role to play in this world. But it also create, you know, requires a certain measure of confidence, a certain measure of self-worth, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created me for a purpose, and I have, you know, a role to play in the, you know, in the ultimate unfolding of the Geula and in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan for the world. And I'm one with HaKadosh Baruch Hu means I'm worthy of being one with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So at the same time, it requires tremendous selflessness, tremendous humility. At the same time, tremendous confidence, tremendous self-worth that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are kind of together, united, you know, in this way. So in a certain sense, you know, that's a kind of a communing with the Ribbono Shel Olam in, you know, I guess, in a way that borders on what his Bezus meant originally, but coming at it from an entirely different approach, an entirely different angle. And that's a high madrega, you know, in its own right. I guess Mashalom Al Davidoyme is a story from Chelm. I don't know if people are familiar with the Chelm stories, if you read Olam Einu and all that kind of stuff growing up. But there's a story of Chelm, of a guy who is afraid to go into the swimming pool. There's a whole swimming pool. He's afraid to go in because he's afraid if he goes into the swimming pool, he'll forget who he is. People look the same when they're in the pool. They're going to take off most of their clothing. He's going to forget who he is. I guess maybe he could have a striped bathing suit or something. But so he ties a red string around his toe. So he remembers, this is me. So when he comes out, he'll be able to look at his red string. Ah, that's me. What happens is, as they're all swimming around in the pool, the string falls off and goes on his friend's foot. So he gets out of the swimming pool and he sees a red string on his friend's foot. So he says to his friend, he said, I know who you are, but who am I? You have my red string, so you must be me, but now who am I? So the point of the Maisa, I have this stupid story, but the point of the Maisa is a very profound lesson, which is oftentimes we think we are the strings that we tie around our toes. We think we are this, that, or career, or community, you know, friend group, whatever, aspiration, however we identify ourselves and box ourselves into our different denominations and identities that we have, we do so based on, you know, society around us. And what Rabbi Nachman, which I think is a healthy thing, is encouraging us to say is, no, I am a bria of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I am created, you know, in the image of God, and I have a role to play in a Kadosh Baruch Hu's world, nothing more, nothing less. In a certain sense, it's not relieving us of responsibility, but understanding fundamentally that's who I am. In a certain sense, that brings one to tremendous unity with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I think that there's healthy aspects to it, but I think that also there's a danger to it. And what I mean by that is the following. This is a very high madrega. It's not the same as his bodhidus that we started with, self-control. That's hard work. And I'm not saying this is easy, but you know. So either this is easier or not. If it is easier, you know, in a certain sense, it's not this Vedas that we were talking about before, you know, then I'm not sure what exactly, you know, it accomplishes. Meaning, Miman of Shach. Either way, I have a problem with it. I have a problem with it if it's hard to achieve. If this is really a high madrig of a person uniting completely with the Kadosh Baruch Hu and stripping himself of all ego and self-worth, but at the same time understanding that he's, you know, has value in the eyes of the Kadosh Baruch Hu and united completely with the Bria and the trees and the grass and all that. If that is, and again, it's not traditional Hizbaydus. They'll tell you, no, Hizbaydus, look in the Rambam. That's not what Hizbaydus means. The definitions have been conflated and the methods are not the same. So, yes, the concept is traditional. If a person can unite with the Kadosh Baruch Hu in this way, that's a really high madrega. And if a person is not holding on that, then it takes on a very external, kind of superficial tone to it. If a person's sitting in nature and kind of talking to himself, fooling himself, as the Rambam says in the Maran Avukum, that he's thinking about the Ribbono Shel Olam, when in fact he doesn't even know the Ribbono Shel Olam at all to think about him. So either it's a very high madrega, you know, which is irrelevant again, just like the old Hizbaididus, or it's a low madrega, in which case I think it's probably more external and superficial. So that's why I don't think it's, you know, it's a part of our traditional, Avodas Hashem, but I think it's important to understand where it's coming from, and there is a part of it which I think is beneficial to us. I think the kind of Hizbaididus that we should be thinking about is Hizbaididus of the Balei Musar, the Balei Chassidus, which is, I guess, I don't want to use mindfulness because that's like a pop psychology term, but, and that's a Jewish in all of its implications, but a time to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh, not in a sad, depressed way, but in a way that gives us time to disconnect, to think about our trajectory in life, and what we want to accomplish. And I think there is a dimension to that that is perhaps revealed through the, you know, the Bresival model, even if we don't embrace it fully. And that is that we should serve Hashem, you know, not only think about our cheshbon ha-nefesh and where we're going, but also to think about perhaps serving our Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, in our own way, not creating services, you know, on our own and creating our own methods, but not judging ourselves based on, you know, the accomplishments of others. I think that is something, you know, that we could probably focus on a little bit better, which is understanding that each one of us is unique, each one of us, you know, is a bria in the creation of the world, and by detaching a little bit, even if we're not reaching the madregas of nevuah, I think we free ourselves and liberate ourselves to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu at our own pace, and a lot of times that can speed us up, that can get us to places we couldn't previously have gotten. See, a lot of times people in doing mitzvahs and in growing spiritually look around at their friends and say, well, look at where this guy is, look where that guy is, look where I am. Well, I'm not doing too bad because I'm better than this one, I'm better than that one, so I'm pretty good. And they start to think, you know, highly of themselves. If they're looking around at their friends, they could also think, you know, think negatively of themselves. Oh, where am I? Look at where he is, look where that, you know, that one is. And now they begin to feel inferior. Neither one of those is healthy. It's good for a person to grow at their own rate, at their own pace, in their own way. And everyone has, you know, their own mission, which is not going to be the same as anyone else. So in a certain way, in a certain sense, it frees us to grow at our own pace. And that is critically important. Not just taking time to detach, you know, and think about life, right? And think about what we want out of life. That's obviously critically important. But thinking about life, you know, individually and growing in our own way. The Degel Machne Ephraim has a comment on a Mishnah Novice we're probably all familiar with, but he takes an entirely different direction. The Mishnah says, Hishtado liyos ish b'makom sheinish. A person should always attempt to be, you know, the guy, the man, whatever, or the individual, when there's no other individuals around. Meaning, no one wants to do this or that for the community, you should step up and do it. Hishtado liyos ish b'makom sheinish. However, the Degel Machne Ephraim, who's the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, takes it differently. He says, no, what it means is, probably an additional interpretation, al derech ha-Jewish, that hishtadlu yos ish, we should attempt to be the kind of individual who serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'makom she'inish. Like, where there's no one else watching, that's the way we serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu always, that's really the most productive. Because then we're going at our own pace. We're going in our own way, in a way that's healthy for us, not because of, you know, what our neighbors are doing, but because what we need, you know, in our own way, which is kind of the best way. Rav Tzadok writes also, when a person is davening, a lot of times we're focused, I often think men have an advantage. I put the towels over my head, you know, I'm in my own world, and I happen to sit at the front of the rabbi, I guess, to sit at the front of the shul. I don't see anyone else. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I don't turn around the whole day. I don't know, they could be all talking or something. I don't hear them. I'm doing my thing. What happens behind me, you know, I hear them, hopefully, you know, davening too, but it almost doesn't matter. Like, yeah, I get to put the towels on my. I'm in my own world. I kind of feel bad for my wife. You know, she's surrounded by everybody. You can't really do anything about that. And you kind of feel everyone staring at you, a little bit more self-conscious. But a person, however much they can, Tzadok writes that when he's davening, a person should attempt to daven kihu, he's in solitude, as if they're all alone, without paying attention to what other people, you know, are davening and what they are doing. And in that sense, I think it's quite liberating. But also, a person can reach heights that they otherwise, you know, could not get at. Rav Pinkus gives a marshal to this of a pressure cooker. I assume people here know what a pressure cooker is, but maybe not. But we have one in our house. So, but a pressure cooker is pot normally when you boil something in water boils at 212. So once it reaches a temperature of 212, the water, my wife is a chemistry teacher, but the water turns into vapor and evaporates. So you can never get water hotter than 212, because the minute it turns to 212, it turns into a gas. So the hottest water can be is 212. That's because it's at our atmospheric pressure. I hope I don't lose anyone. But the minute you change the atmospheric pressure in a pressure cooker, it's sealed off from our atmospheric pressure, it can get hotter than 212. So if you need to cook certain things, cook better at hotter temperatures than 212, how do you ever get hotter than 212? When it gets to 212, the water boils out. At a pressure cooker, changes the atmospheric pressure. That's why in Denver, right, water boils at a different temperature than it does here, because it's different atmospheric pressure. So then, the water can get even hotter. Coming back, for anyone who I lost with the chemistry, including myself. But so getting back, so too, it is true, in Avodas Hashem, explains with Pincus. If a person's exposed to everyone else, at a certain point, there's only so hot you can get, because you have the society around you that's defining you, that's judging you, that's, you know, that we inevitably, as Rambam said, Adam Nimshach Achar, you know, a person is pulled, is influenced by his surroundings. We define ourselves based on what other people are doing. If a person cuts themselves off, kind of like in a pressure cooker, you can even get hotter. You can reach greater temperatures. A person can, you know, go even further, because he's not pacing himself based on what someone else is doing, pacing himself based on what's good for them. They have, I've never been to a dog race, but I'm told that horse races or dog races, they have a little mechanical something or other that runs around the track. And all the dogs and the horses chase that little thing. Why do they need this mechanical little animal that runs around the track? Because the dogs, in order to keep pace, you know, in order to show, you know, where they have to get to, they keep having this little animal that runs around the track. And they run after that. And that keeps them running fast. If the animal, the little mechanical animal, wouldn't be there, they'd all run slower. So they're all running in order to get ahead of the mechanical animal. But they'll never get that far, because they only push themselves as far as they think they can get. So the same is true in life. Sometimes we pace ourselves based on what others have in mind for us, or based on what society around us is doing. If we stop looking, you know, towards that, we kind of do a hisbaydidus, not in the, you know, necessarily uniting together with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, stripping ourselves of all ego, and perhaps, or even controlling every aspect of our life, which is perhaps beyond really, you know, what's realistically, you know, capable for us, you know, possible for us. But I think hisbaydidus in the Musar sense, in the Chassidish sense, in the sense that the person is taking time to do a cheshbon nefesh, perhaps detaching from the judgments and, you know, the expectations that others have for us, or that we impose on ourselves, removing any of these kind of red strings that limitations that we put on ourselves. But in the Hashem, if we practice this a little bit, not going to hilltops and all that, but, you know, taking time even just to psychologically detach, hopefully we can reach, you know, our greatest potential. Okay.